So we got them all tied up over here now. You want to get one of those off. But we can, while you're doing that, we've got one man ready for a question back here. Let me give you the mic.
Thank you. Yes, I'm right here, Dr. Behe. Welcome to Boston. My name's Eric Anderson, and I'm an engineer. I've also taken a course at Harvard in vertebrate evolution because I was interested to sort of hear it from the horse's mouth. And I think one of the things that I was impressed by is actually what I feel like I've learned is that when people who are skeptics of evolution talk about the fossil record being incomplete, that I think that they're misquoting something, because what I saw was quite a bit of fossils, all kinds of skulls, even very similar organisms, where, for instance, the nasal passages entered the palate at different positions, and very specific descriptions of various bones and where they come together. And although I don't disagree with your main points, sitting in that class, I had to say to myself, well, there are all these layers of rock. There are all these fossils. It's a very complicated situation. There are many, many fossils that seem to be very similar to each other from different groups of organisms that have skulls that are just slightly different from each other. I'm not trying to criticize intelligent design, but what I'm asking is, where does the fossil record and all of those fossils and all of those organisms fit into this picture?
Okay, that's a great question. Thanks very much. It's real easy to get confused in this whole topic because there are many different things you have to get separate. And one thing you got to keep separate from the get-go is the question of common descent versus natural selection. Okay? The question of whether organisms are related versus the question of how did things get here. And you can have all sorts of different scenarios where things did in fact descend from each other, but it was on purpose. There was a plan. Such a process was guided. There was intelligence behind it. As a matter of fact, before Darwin, that was a very popular view. I'm not a historian of science, but I understand that teleological explanations for the diversity of life were pretty common. Darwin's claim to fame was that he thought of a mechanism utterly unintelligent, no teleology whatsoever, that he proposed could explain the complexity and diversity of life. And it is only that mechanism that the idea of intelligent design addresses. It does not address the question of whether there is a line of animals descending one from the other. It only questions whether structures that we know about, such as these things, the flagellum and molecular machinery and other things as well, could have arisen by a random process. And for my money, although there are other interesting questions on the whole topic of evolution, the question of accident versus purpose is the most fundamental. It's the most fundamental philosophically, and it's the most fundamental scientifically, because as I said, before Darwin, ideas about evolution were a dime a dozen, but his big claim to fame was that, as Douglas Fatuma says, as Richard Dawkins says, his mechanism explains the appearance of design, whereas everybody, even people who thought that the animals descended one from another, thought that the design was real. Okay, so a person who is convinced that the fossil record supports common descent might have a good point. I'm no paleontologist, You know, you didn't see any references to fossils in my talk. The question is, how could such a thing happen? How could, you know, these simple creatures turn into these fantastically complex ones? Or how did the fantastically complex cell arise in the first place? And that's the question that intelligent design focuses on. It doesn't have anything to say about descent. It focuses exclusively on the mechanism. How do these things get here? So the argument is that whatever happened, it required direction. It happened on purpose. And that's as far as intelligent design gets you. The other thing is that you have to realize, you have to be very appreciative of the limitations of this argument for intelligent design. Again, it doesn't tell you, it doesn't comment on interesting topics like comma descent. It focuses exclusively on how did this happen. But there's a whole lot of other things it doesn't tell you directly either, like when did this happen? Who was that designer? And many other interesting questions. So this is a very limited argument, and one can easily become confused if you try to take it beyond where it's, or at least by itself, if you try to take it by itself beyond where it can go. You can use other arguments, like philosophical arguments, biblical arguments, theological arguments, to try to build on the basis of things like this, but the scientific evidence, biochemical evidence, which I think is the most sure foundation for addressing these topics, only takes you a certain way. It addresses a critical point, but it doesn't address more than that critical point. Should I be repeating the questions?
No, it's okay.
No, okay.
For
confidence in science in our culture is the so-called supposed self-correcting nature of science. That is, somebody does an experiment, and if he gets an answer that is wrong, then somebody else does the same experiment or something similar and points out that the other one was incorrect. So I'm wondering if Doolittle has acknowledged the error that he made, or have others in the scientific literature, other than yourself, pointed out his error?
It's interesting. His article came out, and I was surprised to see, as you might imagine, I went over to the library and looked up the reference and read it once and read it twice and read it again and finally saw that he had misinterpreted this. He'd come misread it. So I went and emailed, "Dear Dr. Doolittle," and the next day I got an email back, which was titled "Oops," in which he acknowledged happily that, I misread that, but he didn't think it was a big deal. He said, "We've got lots and lots of evidence for evolution." And he'll be glad to tell you about other topics like gene duplication and stuff. But what was critical about this was that it was an experimental result. It wasn't, here we've got these relationships. Of course, we can put them together. This was purportedly a demonstration that this idea of irreducible complexity was wrong. And so I attached to it more importance than Russell Doolittle did. Other than him, no, nobody else has said anything about it. But nonetheless, I point this out in talks I give, and so he gets a lot of emails from people who have attended my talks, and he has a pre-printed form that he now sends out to to people who email him. And
I'm a computer programmer, and I worked very briefly in the field of bioinformatics. And in self-defense, I had to learn a little biochemistry and biology. And I inquired into the mathematical basis for the algorithms, And what the literature said is the mathematical basis was randomness in the genome. Do you believe that randomness is real? And if it is real, how do you reconcile randomness with design? Because randomness seems to say there is no design, and design seems to say there is design. So how can the two be reconciled if randomness is real? And I'm sorry if that's a confused question.
No, I think I have the gist of it. That's a very deep question. Because the randomness is a philosophically loaded term. But you can say, well, is randomness, we can't correlate it with any, we can't correlate mutations with anything. So maybe mutations are random. And I would say maybe most mutations are random and some ain't. How can you tell? I mean, how many out of the fraction of mutations that happen in the world, or a fraction of changes in DNA sequences that happen in the world, how many do we see? One in 10 to the, 10 to the 20th or something? So you simply can't say that because, Joe Smith in his lab over here grew a plate of E. coli and, didn't see any specific pattern, therefore all mutations that have occurred in the history of life were random. If, additionally, you have to worry about what you mean by the word random, is it random just our ignorance, or is it in some ontological sense random so that not even God knows what's going to go on? If you mean the latter, that not even God would know, then no, you can't reconcile that with design. So clearly, mutations are not random in that sense. I would deny that all changes in DNA sequences or changes in organisms were random. As a matter of fact, I specifically deny that. I say some are intended. Clearly design is involved.
Excuse me. I'm really nervous, so if I sound strange, I am nervous. I just want to say, you keep talking about Darwin. Evolutionary theory has gone far beyond Darwin and is no longer stuck on small incremental changes. J. Stephen Gould at Harvard formulated his observation that it was, in theory, punctuated equilibrium. Long periods of time where conditions on the planet remain the same, sudden changes happen, glaciation or removal of the glaciers, etc. And at those periods of time, big changes happen suddenly, quickly in the on the geological time scale. That's just the point I wanted to make about why do you keep harping on Darwin, who published Origin of the Species in the 1800s, 1869 or something like that, when science is constantly changing. Science is trying to find answers, looks for answers, and science marvels at the incredible creation, if you want to call it. Now, another point. A question. If the design is intelligent, then that would imply that when viruses mutate, it's God's plan. People are very worried about the bird flu mutating and causing another pandemic. Well, then that would be God's will, because he intelligently fixed it so the DNA of the virus, and I don't know if it's an RNA virus or a DNA virus for the flu, would be his plan. Now, if the design is so intelligent, why are there evolutionary kind of mistakes? Why is the panda a vegetarian with carnivore teeth? Why does the panda have a paw and instead of a thumb? J. Stephen Gould wrote an essay on the panda's thumb, and the panda's thumb is not a thumb at all. It's a bone spur. And with that bone spur that functions as a pseudo-thumb that has no muscular control, he holds the bamboo. So why would an intelligent designer design a panda vegetarian with carnivore teeth? Why would an intelligent designer design some fish, like the African lungfish, with lungs? Why would he fix it so that a tadpole had to metamorphose into a frog? Why would our embryo have gill slits that, you know, the bone structure, we get jaws and then the inner ear bones? Why would we have a vestigial tailbone?
Maybe I can try to address your questions. All of them are very good. Let me start with the last ones. And let me just point out something. Questions like, you know, why does the panda do this? Or why would this have happened? I just want to draw attention. What kind of a question is that? It's essentially a question is, why would God do it this way? And it's a theological question. It is not a scientific one. And I'm...
It's refuting your argument that the design is intelligent.
No, it's not. It's... A structure which is intelligently designed does not have to strike us as aesthetically pleasing or functional or anything like that. Intelligent design means that there is a purposeful arrangement of parts. The purposeful arrangement of parts can be can strike us as, you know, gawky or for an evil purpose or something. But intelligent design is simply the purposeful arrangement of parts. If you want to make a further argument that, say, God wouldn't have done it this way or some such thing, then you're leaving science behind and you're entering into theology. Let me make a brief remark before I go to another section of your question, and that is, I think it was in Nature or Science, a couple weeks ago, there were an article about how very, very well adapted is the panda's thumb to its purpose of stripping bamboo leaves from its plant, from the plant. So the point is that what Stephen Jay Gould says God shouldn't have done, or which is a poor design, may not be. That may reflect our limited understanding of the system at hand. Your first point was that, well, Darwin talked about numerous successive slight modifications. As a matter of fact, he insisted upon it. But science has traveled a long way since then. We know about large changes. We know about large changes in the climate, as you were talking about. We know about large changes that can happen in the genome. We know about master genes called Hox genes, which control the development of body plans and so on. So that maybe bigger changes can occur. Well, let me say that that hasn't been ruled out yet, and a lot of people have been speculating about it. But a lot of people, including a lot of Darwinists, are quite skeptical that large changes can explain much of what we see in biology. And furthermore, the reason that I concentrate on molecular systems, other than the fact that I'm a biochemist and that's what we study, is that you can't get the bacterial flagellum in one big, large change. It doesn't matter if some ice age came or a comet hit the Earth, or even if a Hox gene mutated, that's not going to give you the many different parts that have to function together very specifically in order to give a molecular machine such as that, or the other molecular machines of the cell. It may be that large changes have, in fact, done something in life over history, but it's very much an open question right now. I myself am skeptical that they have done They might have done something, but I am skeptical that it would be kind of an additive process which would construct some new complex functional system such as, say, an eyeball or an organ such as that. It might be responsible for the panda's thumb, but it's not responsible for the panda itself. So I hope that at least gives you a little understanding of what I think about it.
Hello, I'm Amos. I'm an undergraduate student at a university nearby. And I read a book written by Kenneth Miller at Brown University. The name of the book is Finding Darwin Scott.
Yes.
Yeah. By the way, he's a serious Christian, but in his book, he has a whole chapter arguing against your idea of irreducible complexity.
Yes.
In which he said that, like, if in the nature, if you can find a lot of examples of less complicated, less intricate, and less... Like a less developed version of those really complex organs or complex biochemical system, mm-hmm. then your arguments for irreducible complexity basically would break down. And then he quoted a lot of examples from the nature, which include like your famous example of a flagellum. Mm-hmm. He said that in the nature, a lot of different strains of bacteria actually have much less developed kind of flagellum, and they can still function really well, like for their own purposes. So, different versions, even simpler or even more complex flagellum, can exist in the nature for different strains of bacteria to survive in different environments. So, and he gave a lot of other examples even at a biochemical basis. You wrote in your book about a Krebs cycle, which you said the Krebs cycle is a very complex biochemical cycle.
No, I didn't. That was his example. Oh, he brought that up himself.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So he quoted that like after in the Journal of Molecular Evolution, he can find a lot of examples, some examples saying there in some scientists already found. Krebs cycle, which with fewer components, but which still work. And he also quoted. He also said, like in the nature, you can find a lot of different types of eyes of the eyeball with much simpler structures. Like so, he then suggests if as long as like for example for a very simple organism, if suddenly, it evolved light-sensitive cells, and then it favors its ability to escape from predators and mm-hmm. something, and then it can just acquire this trait and carry on evolving in until it becomes a more complex structures later mm-hmm. on. And I'm just wondering, like, what would your response to that?
Well, I've responded to Ken Miller's arguments in a couple of places, including a number of those articles and book chapters that I had on the board. Also, if you go to that website, you'll see that I have responded to many of them. Let me just say relatively briefly. First of all, I think none of his examples are pertinent. None of them. The cilium. I think what you're thinking of is the cilium rather than the flagellum. There are two structures which are confused because, one, the cilium is sometimes called a flagellum. In his book, he talked about different structures of cilia that had fewer components than the one that I had pictured in Darwin's black box. However, if you read Darwin's black box, I said, this is the standard cilium. It needs at least the microtubules, the motor protein, and the connectors to function. I didn't say it has more bells and whistles on it. I didn't say it needed the more bells and whistles. And if you look at the ones that function and the ones that he pictures, they all have those necessary components, although some are missing bells and whistles. What's more, if you read the literature about those, you'll see that all of those so-called simpler cilia are breakdown products of the complex one. That is, it is thought by evolutionary biologists that the common 9 plus 2 cilia is the progenitor of the ones that Ken Miller called simpler ones. So it's kind of like saying, well, yeah, you called this, you know, this car irreducibly complex, but look over here, here's a radio. And it's a simpler component. Your car's got a radio in it. And you say, yeah, but you know, that radio was torn out of a car. And you know, it didn't arise independently and the more complex car be built on it. It was taken from the more complex object itself. And it is not a Darwinian explanation to postulate a very complex parent system that over time gives rise to simpler systems. That's the same thing with the bacterial flagellum. There's something called the type 3 secretory system, which is a component of the flagellum, and which now research people who work in the field think was derived from the entire functioning flagellum over time. So there have been a couple examples of this on examples that he cited in his book, where he, it seems in reading it that, you know, these simpler systems could have given rise to the more complex ones, but in fact it was the reverse, and that's what's thought by the community of scientists who are investigating it. And there are many, many points of disagreement between Ken and myself, but I'll just refer you to the website now, but thanks for that question.
I got a comment and a question. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to manipulate this. The comment is, I'm no scientist, but I do know how to use Google. And I just spent a couple hours looking around before this talk, and I found that there is actually a theory about the psyllium and that it's descended from the cytoskeleton, and that the cytoskeleton has all those same things, the tubulin, the dynein, and the nexin, all those things you talk about in the book. I mean, he goes on to talk about intermediate stages and stuff like that. So it sounds almost like you're being a little disingenuous when you say that scientists don't have these evolutionary stories when often they do. And the question I have is, science, I guess, basically you need to have a theory has to be falsifiable and has to be predictive. So how would you falsify intelligent design, or are you just going to keep on demanding that we label every organism in the life family tree? And what predictions would intelligent design make that one could test?
Okay, very, very good questions. Well, in regard to your first comment, you can find lots of things on the internet. I only count things that appear in science journals. Occasionally in science journals, there are speculative articles about the psyllium and flagellum. But even the authors who are writing them call them speculative articles. And when I say there are no explanations, I mean no real explanations, no ones that are quantitative, backed up by experiment, specific enough to the task. The psyllium, the eukaryotic psyllium, which is different from the flagellum that I showed you, has hundreds of protein parts. And typically, when you read speculative papers on how the psyllium arose, people will say, well, you know, perhaps, you know, this protein, you know, was good for some purpose and then, you know, learned how to do this thing, and very, very hand-wavy type of things. I discount those. As a matter of fact, in my book, Darwin's Black Box, I cited several of those speculative scenarios about cilia and flagella in my discussions of them. And I said, yes, these things exist, but that's all that exists. And that goes along with what I quoted Franklin Harold, who said, all we have are wishful speculations. I agree, Darwinism has always had wishful speculations. But speculations are easy to come by. What's harder to come by are serious explanations. The second point, Gene.
Falsifiability
Of falsifiability. Oh, okay, great. Thank you. Russell Doolittle thought that he had falsified my claims. And he thought he had falsified them by pointing to experimental evidence. If the experiment had actually turned out the way that he thought it had instead of the way it actually did, I would have had a lot of explaining to do.
But not really, because you could just go off to any number of...
Okay, whoa, just a second. If I said that the blood clotting cascade required intelligent design because it was irreducibly complex, and Russell Doolittle showed me experiments that it could work, it was not irreducibly complex, my claim would be falsified. In Ken Miller's book, he talks about the what's called directed or evolution in the laboratory, where a man named Barry Hall tried to see how a bacterium called E. coli or Escherichia coli might develop a new metabolic system. And so he did an experiment in which he knocked out one pre-existing metabolic system called the lac operon and tried to get it to re-evolve. And Ken makes a big deal out of this, but if you look at the papers themselves, his work actually shows much, much less than Ken Miller claimed and is completely consistent with claims of intelligent design, that complex systems require intelligent intervention, which Barry Hall intervened at a number of steps to help the system along, and that you know you can get small changes in pre-existing systems. If his experiments had been as Ken Miller said, then my claim that complex biochemical systems could not develop would have been experimentally falsified. And he, in his book, says this shows Behe is wrong. He was incorrect. If you go back and read the original papers, you'll find out that, like Russell Doolittle, he read the papers wrong. But nonetheless, he said this claim is falsifiable. So I think one strength of intelligent design is that it is easily falsifiable. It can be shown to be wrong, if it is wrong, by rather standard experiments in molecular biological laboratories. Let me turn around that question. Let me ask, how can we falsify Darwinian claims? Any Darwinist you'll talk to will say things like the flagellum arose by random mutation and natural selection. How do you falsify that? Suppose that some scientist said, I'll show you. I'm going to show that your claims are wrong and that Darwinism is right. I'm going to knock out the flagellum from a strain of bacteria, knock out the genes for the flagellum, go in and grow a strain of bacteria under some vague selective pressure for motion for thousands and thousands of generations. If at the end of that experiment, some new spiffy complex system for motion, not a new flagellum, but just some complex system, if that were produced, my claims about irreducible complexity and design would be out the window. But if at the end of that experiment, nothing much happened, would the Darwinist say, oh, you're right, and I'm wrong? No. He would say, ah, we didn't wait long enough. We used the wrong strain of bacterium. We didn't apply the right selective pressure, and so on and so on. Contrary to common thinking, I think the situation is exactly opposite to how it's often portrayed. Intelligent design, it can be falsified straightforwardly. But Darwinian claims are extremely difficult to falsify. As a matter of fact, there have been famous examples where Darwinists would claim one thing, and it turned out to be the opposite in nature, and they would absorb that without missing a step. A few years ago, it was shown that vertebrate embryos did not have as similar of a structure as many Darwinian biologists had claimed, and it had been claimed that that very similar structure was very strong evidence for Darwinian evolution, but when it turned out that the structures were pretty variable, they say, oh, look, you know, evolution can vary even the earliest steps of vertebrate development. So on the one hand, conserved embryos were evidence for Darwinian evolution, and on the other hand, variable ones were also. So, as I said, I think the situation is exactly the opposite. The Darwinian claims are well nigh unfalsifiable, at least their basic claims are. But intelligent design is much more open to falsification.
Dr. Behe, I read your book about 8 years ago until it got too irreducibly complex for my layman's mind to understand it. But I thought the most compelling argument in your book, for layman's purposes, for takeaways, for apologetic purposes, is the argument about the guy who arranges, who can put all these machine parts together, that it doesn't, that for a cornea to get together with a retina, to evolve together with an optic nerve, with eyelashes, etc., and to somehow get all assembled to put together an eye. You had an eye example in your book, right? And I don't know if that's the watchmaker example, but you did not present that tonight. So my question is, did I miss the main point of the book, or is this not the main takeaway for a layman? A powerful argument that there is a guy who assembled all these machines in your body. And not only are the chances that how can a mousetrap, you know, evolve over thousands of iterations into a mousetrap in a bar, and how can a mousetrap in a bar evolve into a mousetrap bar and a hammer, etc., to get these six pieces? The chances are so mathematically remote. Then you have a body with thousands of machines. That is the main argument for us laymen as an evangelist. Does that work? Has that been attacked by your critics? Is that a flawed argument? Do we sound unscientific if we use that? Is that the main point for evangelism?
Well, you'll have to decide that. I'm not the evangelist here. I'm just a humble biochemist. I'm sorry. I hadn't known that. Maybe I would have concentrated on other things. But what I just concentrated on tonight was the way I see the argument for design structured, you know, in a logical fashion, I guess. And whether that's the best thing for general people or for apologetic purposes or whatever is I guess a prudential judgment, but it's quite true. One easy thing that makes a big impact on people is simply to discover that life is really, really, really complex and elegant and sophisticated, and it goes all the way down to your toenails. It's not just on the surface. You know, the foundation of life, you know, the complexity you see at the surface is nothing compared to the complexity that underlies it in the cell. An example I'd like to use is maybe a jet plane. You look at the surface, you look at the wings and rudder and stuff, you say, oh, this is a complicated shape. But it isn't anything compared to what's inside. You know, the computers that control it, the engine parts and so on. Same thing with a body, or take a computer. The keyboard looks complex, the screen looks complex, but it's when you take the cover off and you look into the guts of the computer that you really encounter the real complexity. And it's the same with the cell. So I found that many people think of cells and such as just kind of goo, you know, just jello, gelatinous type things. And yeah, but that I think impresses people when they find out how sophisticated is the foundation of life. I think we're missing the middle here. Nobody in the middle is getting a chance.
Yes. Dr. B, I have a short question. Isn't a design already a metaphysical concept? And you've moved out of the realm of science to a certain extent. I mean, intelligent design, who are we aiming for?
Okay.
Who is a designer?
Okay.
Designer is already a concept that is non-falsifiable. So if we don't get our epistemology correct, what is science, what is history, what is fantasy?
Okay.
How are we going to deal with this issue?
That's an excellent question. And whether the concept of design is metaphysical or not is reasonable. It may be, because design implies intelligence. We're intelligent folks. You know, is that because of some extra capability we have that is not, you know, generally shared by nature? Well, yeah, maybe so. But nonetheless, for the working scientist or for the average person on the street, design isn't all that metaphysical because we can see it. We can see it in structures. We see it every day. We're good at recognizing it. So whether it's metaphysical or not, whether there's, you know, millennia of philosophical disputes about its very nature, that's interesting, but it does not affect our judgment. And we can perceive design in physical structures, as I tried to show. Additionally, I think design is falsifiable. Just think of the old man on the mountain. Somebody who saw it for the first time might say, I think that was designed. And then somebody else come up and say, well, you know, no, look, you know, this is just boulders that kind of fell against each other. There's no particular arrangement to it, and so on. So I think it could have arisen easily by nature. I think design is falsifiable. It certainly does have a metaphysical component, but I don't think that interferes so much with coming to very practical decisions about what structures are designed and which are not.
Just have time for one more question, and that'll be right here. And afterwards, I'm sure Dr. Behe will stay around for a little while. For those of you who are just dying to ask him the one more question, you can ask him that personally.
All right, so when discussing intelligent design with scientists who aren't so inclined towards it, you often hear that them claim that if we accept intelligent design, then the field of biology will be reduced to rubble because it depends on evolution. So what's the best way to respond to this?
Well, if you're restricting your answers to polite responses, you could say things like, well, you know, you could point out that the vast majority of biologists are involved essentially in just elucidating how cells work now, in the present, not in the question of how cells came to be the way they are. So no matter whether Darwinian evolution is true or not, you know, it's something that doesn't affect the great majority of working biologists. Another point is a very interesting one. You can actually look at the curricula for biology majors in many colleges and universities, and molecular biology majors and biochemistry majors and stuff, and ask how many of those institutions require a course on evolution. Turns out that surprisingly few do. I can't think of examples, but go through course catalogs. Most biology departments don't require courses on evolution. But if that were the case, how could such students graduating from such programs be well educated. They all require courses in physics, in math, in molecular biology, in biochemistry, in organic chemistry, but it's the odd one that requires a formal course in evolution. You can say a lot of other things as well. You can differentiate the idea of Darwin's theory of evolution from relationships between organisms, like as implied, as common descent implies. Nobody uses Darwin's theory of random mutation, or I shouldn't say no one. An extremely small subset of biologists use that, and their results are generally published in small specialty journals that don't affect people's work. So I would disagree with those claims.
Well, we want to thank you for coming.
My pleasure.
Just a few comments and just a few instructions before we wrap up. As Dr. Behe mentioned, what he addressed tonight on intelligent design, of course, focuses on just one aspect of this issue. And one of the questions that he passed on answering is, who is the intelligent designer? Well, that's why we're here. That's our field. And here at Hope Christian Church, we believe that God is the intelligent designer. But we also believe that God is more than just an intelligent designer. He's also a being whom you can know personally as a father and as a friend. And if you would like to know more about how you could know God personally, we would be happy to help you investigate that aspect of the story. There are three ways that you can get in touch with us if you would like to have that dialogue. One of the ways is just stick around and talk to me afterwards. You could do that. A second way that you could do that is you'll see on your seat or around your seat a card. And if you would just put your name on this and check the appropriate block of the information that you are interested in, you can leave that with one of the ushers as you leave the door, and we'd be happy to get in touch with you and continue the dialogue. Also, if you wanted to get in touch with us and ask us any questions, you could do that by contacting our website, and that's real easy to get to. It's hopechristianchurch.org. Just run it all together, hopechristianchurch.org. Now, one thing that we have for you on that website is Dr. Behe has been very gracious tonight to allow us to tape this presentation and conversation, and we will have it on the web so that you could listen to it, or you could download it on MP3 format or whatever and have it available. And he's been very gracious to allow you to have that without charge, so we thank you for that. So I mentioned there's four ways that you can get in touch with us, and the last one is come on Sunday morning, 10:45, right here. But we've been glad that you've been here, and two other things that I want to mention to you, there is a book table in the back that most of you have seen, and that will be available to you. It has a lot of different works along this theme, and also back in this corner we have refreshments for those who would like to stay and mingle for a while. But it's been great to have you here this evening. Thanks for coming. Have a good evening.